we are born to be kings. We're the
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the tail. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This week we present the second half of my most recent conversation with Sean Michael Vogt about Roger Zelazny's Amber series. Last week, on our last episode at least, we covered Volume 3, Sign of the Unicorn. On this episode, we pick back up with The Hand of Oberon and The Courts of Chaos. I'm going to start the episode back a few seconds earlier than where we left off last time because I was in the process of asking Sean what I thought was a fairly interesting question. So we'll pick up there with me asking the question and his answer. We'll continue on through The Hand of Oberon and The Courts of Chaos, and then we'll look back at how we feel about this series' place in science fiction and fantasy history. So without further ado, here we go with our next installment in The Summer of Zelazny, Sean Michael Vogt and me discussing The Hand of Oberon and The Courts of Chaos, finishing up the Corwin cycle of Roger Zelazny's The Chronicles of Amber. Now, here's the question I have for you, and this is kind of one of the main questions I've been waiting to ask you. Do you think that Zelazny planned from the beginning that Ganelon would be who he is? We still haven't said it out loud, I don't think. Again, we're just throwing the spoilers out there, so we're going to reveal it in a second. I'm just teasing it a little bit here, but do you think that Zelazny planned from the beginning, or did he make it up and have to sort of retrofit it as the books were going on?
I think he just went with it, with whatever came, with whatever, as the story went along, where it moved. I think he just went with it. I don't think in Guns of Avalon that he had decided that was going to be, you know, who we're talking about. I think he was just there as, you know, a cool little companion that could help Corwin out. But when we got to Sign of the Unicorn, I think that's around the time that he started, you know what, I can do something a little more with this guy.
Yeah.
And he slowly started building, and then later he started getting the hints. Because there weren't many early on, you know, when he was first introduced. He just seemed like a, you know, kind of cool human companion to Corwin.
In fact, a lot of the stuff he does a lot of the stuff that Ganelon does in The Guns of Avalon doesn't match with Oberon. It seems out of character for what we know later. It seemed in character for Ganelon. It seems out of character for Oberon. Even pretending to be Ganelon.
I think the story just, you know, kind of, it started pointing itself in that direction in his mind, and he said, okay, well, I can do this, and I can build on it, and I can kind of explain away anything that went on in Guns of Avalon, because, you know, this is Oberon, who's the master strategist and schemer.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you look at the convoluted chain of events that goes on through Sign and ends in Quartz, and it was all his master plan, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's things that he set in motion way before any of this was going on. So, you know, you can't put it past him like, oh, okay, well, no, Ganelon couldn't have been yada, yada, yada. No, he's been shown to be a master planner.
Right. Yeah, I you know, when I read it the last time a couple of months ago, I felt like, because I knew going in that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered it. And I felt like I could almost point you to the page number in Sign of the Unicorn where Zelazny suddenly decided that. Because I just feel like Oberon's character changes fairly dramatically. It's not totally overt, because Zelazny was certainly talented enough to kind of gloss it over and keep it consistent. But you can see the moment that the hints start appearing, and you're like, that's where he decided that they're going to be the same character. I honestly don't think in Guns of Avalon that he had any plan to do that at all. In fact, I think there were only supposed to be three books. I knew this better a couple of months ago, and I've kind of forgotten some of the details, but I think there were only supposed to be three books, and there may not even supposed to have been but two originally. And I think that figuring that out about Oberon is one of the things that caused him to lengthen the story out as far, you know, enough to be three books. He just started adding and adding stuff and realized it was going to take another book and another book and another book. So, yeah, I agree. I think he – and it's one of those things where – see, this is one of the things I love. It's one of those things where he had already the first two books were already published. People had already read them, so he couldn't go back and change them there. So he has to change them starting in book three and just kind of explain why. You know, it's like the old exercise that Harlan Ellison used to do. Harlan Ellison would sit in a restaurant or a coffee shop or whatever and write a story, and he would tape the pages to the glass as he finished. And basically that meant he couldn't change anything. If he had a better idea later, it's too bad. He's already stuck them up there where people could be reading them. And it's the same thing here. Zelazny had already stuck Nine Princes in Amber and Guns of Avalon to the glass, and so he couldn't go back and change it. And that's, you know, there's one other thing about that. I'm sorry, this is all just kind of coming to me now. The other thing about that is, because he couldn't go back and change the first two books, that's why we keep getting different versions of the car accident that put him in Greenwood. Right? Because every time he, you know, figured out, you know, first it had to have been Eric that did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of was Blaze. Maybe it was Blaze. And then then it has to be Bran that did it. And so the suspect keeps changing and the circumstances keep changing. The reasons he's in the hospital keep changing. The reason he's under surveillance, because he keeps changing the overall story and making it bigger. And so he has to change the reasons why Corwin is in the situation he's in, because they were trying to get him off the board. His enemies.
Yeah. I mean, it goes through. It's like you said, at first it was Eric. Then it was actually Flora just kind of floated out there that it was a random thug hired by Eric at one point. And then finally it changed to Blaze once that whole triumvirate of evil comes out.
Yeah.
When we get back to the final actual culprit, then we settle on Bran. But it goes through so many convoluted, you know, back and forth. It was this guy. No, it was that guy. And we finally settle on the one guy. Okay, we're done with it. It's Bran.
And you know, it's funny because later on, Zelazny actually refers to that. He has Corwin refer to that in his narrative by saying something about do you remember exactly how he put it? He said something like Corwin says something like, I told him of my tale that involved, you know, cosmic whatever and multiple versions of a car accident. yeah, that's true.
I can't remember the way he actually phrased it, but yes, that's pretty much what it was.
I just like that he even acknowledged it himself, that he's been changing it, you know. He says, yeah, there have been multiple versions, and that's a big part of this story. So, all right, well, so what else, anything else happen in Hand of Oberon that we really need to hit on before we get to the third book?
Let me think. There is, I don't think we've mentioned it, there is a kind of central to the plot that way back when Corwin was stabbed in his room and transported to Earth, he had to stash the jewel, the judgment.
Yeah.
Well, now that we found out that it's Brand, Brand has gone to Earth to get the Jewel of Judgment.
Oh, boy.
And at the end of the Hand of Oberon, we find out exactly what that metal hand of Benedict's was, because Corwin does transport it back and give it to Benedict.
Mm-hmm.
And Corwin ends up recovering the Jewel of Judgment. And also, he kind of, at the very, very end, he figures out who's actually been plotting all these so-called coincidences that don't make sense to him.
Yeah.
And they kind of confirm actually who is behind all the planning at the very end of the novel. So, we're left with them knowing who the bad guy is, knowing who has been behind the kind of counterattack, and we're left with the Jewel of Judgment, which is very important to the next book.
Yeah, and so now we know that Ganelon is actually Oberon, and like I said, I'm dubious of that whole plot. I think if he'd written the whole thing first and then published it, it would have been revised a few times, but that's fine. It makes it fun. And the other thing, though, I believe that we know that, yeah, we know that Brand really wants the jewel, but he doesn't end up with it at the end of this book, but he gets it later, right? I mean, I'm trying to think. Maybe Corwin has it and Brand is chasing him trying to get it. Is that later on? Is that?
In hand, he actually has it. And Corwin finds us out because he travels back to Earth, and we have one of our little kind of linchpin characters that pops in here and there is Bill Roth, attorney.
Yeah.
Anyways, he helps them out. They look for the jewel. They figure out that Brand has it. Fiona comes. Takes him to the one pattern, the primal pattern, and he kind of chases Brand, who is walking the pattern, catches up with him, and he doesn't get it back.
I think that's where the mechanical hand snatches it away or something. And
that's actually a little bit before that. Because there's two attempts to get the jewel back. There's that one, and as they're fighting, Corwin is attuned to the jewel, and Brand isn't,
right?
Or at least not totally.
Yeah,
he draws down that cone of that cyclone.
Yeah. That destroys the horse. The one that destroyed the horse. Yeah.
Yeah, and he teleports out.
Right.
But later on, they try it at Turn-on-Augith. He tries to walk that pattern. But this is where Ganelon once again pops in. He has Brand standing by, or excuse me, Benedict standing by at the center of the pattern. And Corwin is watching Turn-on-Augith. And when it becomes fully fleshed, or however you want to say it, solid, he lets Benedict know. Benedict transports in next to the pattern. And that's where they end up not really fighting, because Brand pops up and pretty much talks to him, but then he ends up freezing him with the jewel.
Right.
And that's where the metal hand comes in. Since it's alien, it's sorcery, whatever, it's not affected by the jewel. And he manages to snatch it away from Brand. And once again, Brand escapes, but now they have the jewel.
That's very good. I appreciate that. That brings me two points. One is, if you're in Turn-on-Augith and you're walking the pattern and you're halfway along it and the moon goes behind a cloud, what happens?
you start sinking through the ground pretty much. And if it goes away for a, you know, good period of time, you just fall, you know,
but what if you're halfway through the pattern and you don't finish it? Is there any consequence for that? Cause you're not supposed to stop, right?
Yeah. I don't know if that would, man, I don't know. I've never thought about that. That's a good question.
I mean, would it mess you up? Would it disattune you from the Trumps, for example, or keep you from walking in shadow because you haven't finished rebranding yourself, you know, or whatever with the pattern? It just occurred to me, you know.
If you tried it, if that was your first try.
Oh, yeah.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
But you know, if you had already walked it, I don't think so. I don't think it would really do anything.
Okay. Well, I would ask Roger, but unfortunately he's not available. So the other question that it begged, is I love the fact that it wasn't a question. I love the fact that the hand, the arm that Benedict has no beginning, right? It's one of those loops. It's one of those things that has gone through time and we don't know where it came from, right? Because Benedict had it in the real world because Corwin got it from him in Tir na n'Ogoth. But mm-hmm. Corwin got it from him in Tir na n'Ogoth from himself in the future. So it's an endless loop with no exactly. beginning and end. I love that.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's a loop, but even the the circumstances in the future when it's taken away by the past Corwin are not quite the same. I mean, they're similar. You have yeah. Mara, you have Benedict, but instead of being in that far future where she's the queen, it's actually just what, a couple days further into the future, a week maybe at the most.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a loop, but it's not quite
yeah.
a closed loop. It's kind of spread out, you know, over different versions, different, you know, dimensions or whatever.
That's a good point. I did something kind of like that in Kings of Oblivion. I had one character encounter himself like a day later in a fog bank and give him some, you know, enigmatic warnings. And then the next day when they're leaving, that character's like, well, we're leaving. I'm supposed to go encounter my younger self in a fog bank and give him these warnings. And the guy that's with him that knows more says, you know, when the time thing comes around again, it doesn't have to happen the same way, you know, it's mm-hmm. it can be different the next time around. You don't, you know, so I just had a little fun with that. So anyway, so yeah, at the end, we discover the truth. So let's get on into the third book now, the third book. And honestly, I had forgotten how much I love, The Courts of Chaos. It's a shorter book. In fact, I have the beautiful black and white cover from probably the late 70s edition where they have the paperbacks where the whole cover's black and the print is in giant white letters and the edges of the paper all the way around are red.
Red.
Oh, yeah. I love those Avon editions from that period. And when I was rereading the series and I read this one, I just couldn't put this book down. I was trying to drag it out because I was reading it while I was writing Baranak, and I wanted to drag it out as long as I could, and I just couldn't because it's so good. I mean, it's shorter, and correct me if you know a different story, but the story I've heard is that Zelazny was having a real dispute with his publisher about 1977, 78, thereabouts. He was really having a dispute with I think it was Doubleday, and they were like, these books were selling great and he wanted more money from them. He wasn't getting paid very much and they would not negotiate with him. And in fact, they said, in fact, you've got to finish the series out and we're not going to give you any extra money. You know, you got to do it at the original thing. And he didn't even want to write it, not because he didn't like the story, but because he was mad at the publisher. And so he just kind of busted this one out and didn't really, it doesn't have a lot of frills, right, beyond just his writing. In other words, he doesn't open any new boxes. He basically, in Courts of Chaos, just says, I'm going to do what I have to do to finish this story. And it's a very streamlined book compared to the maybe 2, 3, and 4. Does that sound right to you?
No, it's very lean. But the thing is that I was thinking when I was reading it earlier, I know it's a short book and you speed through it, but the amount of information and stuff that he managed to convey in such a short amount of time is like really great. You're thinking it's a longer novel, but then you're at the end of it.
And
you're
yes.
like, oh wow. Now that wasn't very long. I mean, the one thing that he does kind of incorporate that leads directly to the Merlin series is when he draws the new that's the one new thing that he does insert in there.
Yeah, the new pattern. That is really cool where he sticks the stick in the ground and then draws it out while he's listening to some music and thinking about the Champs-Élysées in Paris or something, right?
Yeah, he draws his pattern. He draws from his best memories, his experiences, his life. That's basically what Dworkin did. Mm. And that's why he was he was damaged when the pattern was damaged, because as he said somewhere in that back in there, you know, I've discovered that the pattern is me and I am the pattern. And if the pattern is damaged, then so am I. So, you know, it basically, whoever draws it out, if anything happens to it, then it happens to you as well.
I think that's one of the things that maybe readers were disappointed with the Merlin series about, because the Merlin series really is about Merlin, and he encounters some of the other relatives. But, you know, going into it, I remember the main thing that that disappointed me about it is I wanted to see Corwin again. Even if he wasn't a main character, I just wanted to see Corwin again. And I wanted to see that universe. I wanted to see this Corwin universe that was patterned on the 19th century Paris, Champs-Élysées. And we don't get any of that. In fact, we barely get Corwin at all in those five books. So that, I mean, when you read the second five, just as a quick little preview here, and I guess you and I will eventually talk about those too. But when you read the second five going in, just understand, folks, they're not Corwin books, and you really don't see Corwin in them. And I mean, if you're just sitting there turning the pages, waiting on Corwin in this new universe, you're going to be extremely disappointed. Was that your experience the first time you read the second five, or were you just kind of more willing to take it as it came?
I read these back in, high school.
Yeah.
I believe the second part.
Yeah.
And I was just so happy that I was getting a new Amber series that at first it wasn't really bothering me, but, you know, and I took a while to get all of them. It took me a while to get every single edition books in the series, excuse me. And as I got further through it, I started feeling a lot like you just mentioned. I was like, you know what? You know, I like Merlin. I like Merlin a lot. He's a good mm-hmm. character. But I kind of want to know what's going on with Corwin, and why do we have this mysterious pattern here that we're not really exploring? Because basically, up to a point, that's what a lot of the characters are saying, a lot of the relatives, older relatives. Oh, well, you know, he mentioned that he was going to go off and explore his pattern. But you just get these mentions, and it turns out that that's not really what he was doing anyways at the end. So we never really got to see what was going on in his world that he made.
Yeah.
But, you know, after rereading it, you know, I got over that. You know, I'm perfectly fine with mm-hmm. it being a Merlin series.
Right. Because,
you know, we had five books of Corwin, and we had Merlin pop up at the end. And he kind of did the reverse. We had five books of Merlin, and then Corwin pops up at the end. So,
yeah, that's true.
But it would have been, I think he would have really, just my opinion, the way he ended both parts of the series, that he had a lot more to tell in the world. And I think we mm-hmm. would have gotten another set of, you know, Amber books that possibly we would have explored, you know, that very idea that we didn't get.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll mention right now, we can come back in more detail in a later episode. There are several short stories that come after the 10th book. And there's also the Gregory Betancourt, unauthorized by Zelazny, but authorized by his, I guess, his former wife, prequels that are really about Oberon. We can get into those later on in a later episode. Maybe we can do we'll obviously do a couple episodes on Merlin if we get a chance later on, and then maybe we can do like one more on everything else, you know.
I actually, to tell you the truth, man, I have not read the prequels. I kind of stayed away from them. I was very excited about them. And then a couple of friends of mine that read them told me that, you know, if you're a Zelazny fan, that it's not the same.
No, it's not the same. He uses a number of tricks to try to make it seem kind of the same, but obviously nobody is Roger Zelazny.
No.
But I read them just because it was more Amber. And I needed it. I wanted it. Now, obviously, I don't want to go too far off this tree, but the two writers best qualified to have done more Amber because they were either close with Zelazny or acknowledged that they were totally influenced by him mm-hmm. are Stephen Bruce and Neil Gaiman. And they both have stated publicly that they would never write an Amber book or story because they knew mm-hmm. that wasn't what Roger would have wanted.
Yes.
So, then there's me. And then someday I wish that they would, you know, let me do it, but I wouldn't, but I'm nobody. So, but I feel like I could, I feel like I could at some point, but in the meantime, I'm doing the stuff that I do that's influenced by it. All right. So this is, so let's finish up Courts here and wrap up our show, because we're running short on time. But I've got to say this. I love the Courts of Chaos. It's such a lean, mean, tight little book. It's short, like you said, but it gets the job done. And it's basically one long travelogue. You know, I mean, once things start rolling in it, it is Corwin by himself more than really in any other – I mean, you know, he's by himself in certain scenes, particularly when he's in the dungeon and everything in the earlier books. But most of the time, it's Corwin interacting with his relatives, interacting with people on Earth. But there is a long, long stretch through the middle of Courts of Chaos where it's just Corwin by himself on a journey. And I love it. That's probably my favorite part of the entire five books is when Corwin on Star – I believe he's on Star, right?
I believe it's Star and up to a certain point, and then something fortunately happens.
Yeah. And he and Star following the bird, or the bird comes to him with the jewel.
Comes to him.
And he's like one step ahead of that storm that's blowing through all the different layers of shadow, where Oberon has attempted to repair the pattern, the primal pattern. And it's basically like hit the reset button on the universe almost. And so everywhere that Corwin goes to all these different worlds in shadow, people are acting like it's the apocalypse. You know, everybody's and there's like even one scene where a guy in a cave says,
Corwin.
He says what?
The Angel Corwin, Archangel Corwin.
Yeah. And he says something like, when he comes, he's supposed to say, I go to the ends of the earth or something like
exactly,
that. Right?
Exactly.
And then so Corwin just says it.
And no. That happens later. He at first Corwin's just kind of playing with the situation.
Yeah. Okay.
And with that guy, he says, "I'm not going very far unless I find my horse."
Yeah.
And he just blows it off. But later, when he goes to find his horse, remember the part where there's all the little fairy.
Oh, the little fairy
dwarf creatures.
Yes.
Yeah, that have stolen his horse.
Oh, all right. I've got to tell this story. One of my favorite scenes in the five books is that Corwin was asleep and these little fairy dwarf critters have stolen Star. And so Corwin goes down and follows the trail into a cave and he rips the door off and goes down into their cave and they've got Star tied up and they're sharpening their butcher's equipment like they're going to eat him. And they're all singing and drinking and eating and dancing, you know. And Corwin sits down and they're like so polite to him. Oh, join us, you know. And so he's drinking all this stuff and drinking. And he's so tired and he's so drunk, he starts to pass out. And I just love to visualize this scene where he's looking up at them and they're all dancing and not paying him any attention. And he kind of nods off for a second. And he looks up again and they're all dancing and not paying him attention. And it happens like two or three times. And then he nods off. And when he looks up again, everybody's stopped what they're doing and they're advancing on him with knives. Like they're going to eat him too, you know. Mm-hmm. I just think that's one of the most brilliant. I just love it. It's so effective, that scene. And it's so Zelazny, you know. And so
I enjoy all the little encounters that he has on his random people.
Yeah. Yeah, so many. She's like the Lady of the Lake or something. And and then, of course,
she tries to convince him to stay.
Stay and just let the world end.
Exactly.
And he encounters the bird, Hugi. Which I believe is one of Odin's ravens or something.
Ravens, yeah. And the tree is supposed to be Yggdrasil, the world tree.
Right.
Breaks the branch off of.
And it talks to him and is complaining.
Yeah, it kind of complains. Hey, you know, that kind of hurt.
And see,
you do that.
That's one of my favorite things about Zelazny too, is he takes classical mythological stuff and makes it kind of sound modernish. You know, I love when a mythological creature looks at Corwin and is like, "Hey, buddy, what you doing there?" You know, or something, and they cuss or something. I mean, love that.
There's a part later on when he's actually in the courts where, remember where he meets Duke Borel, the fencing master.
Oh yeah,
and he's just kind of ripping the guy for being archaic and chivalrous and all this other stuff, and he basically just. He doesn't fight him. He ambushes him. He runs away and acts like he's running away. And then he jumps on him with his cloak and stabs him.
Yeah. Oh, basically done, sir.
Yes.
And Corwin says, this ain't the Olympics, pal.
Yeah, exactly.
That is quintessentially Corwin and quintessentially Zelazny. That's the kind of stuff that I love the best. It's stuff that some readers, now let's be fair, some readers read that stuff and say, it's too anachronistic and it throws me out of the story. I'm like, that's what pulls me into the story is that he takes these sort of stuffy classical characters and makes them fun, you know, makes them sound, the changes the vernacular to make them contemporary and all. I just find that hilarious and delightful, right? I mean,
exactly. I mean, but if you look at it, you know, this guy has been everywhere.
Yeah.
He's been to modern times where there's, you know, planes and cars and skyscrapers and cities. And he's also been in these, you know, archaic castles and knights on horses. He's been everywhere. Mm-hmm. So he's going to absorb all of that. And, you know, he's not going to sound like one thing or the other. He's going to have his own. He's experienced everything, basically. That's what I really enjoyed about the family of Amber, that basically they could go anywhere they wanted to and do anything they wanted.
Yeah.
No, but the thing that was kind of funny about it is that instead most of them like stood around scheming instead, you know, they had this wonderful power that they could use to just go and find whatever their heart's desires. And they instead sat around and just plotted about getting the cherry on top, you know, the amber itself, instead of going off and indulging themselves and seeing new sights and wonders. I just thought that was funny.
I guess if you're immortal, though, after a while you get bored with what they see of shadow. They just see shadow as fake, you know? And I mean, it really comes back to how they see Amber as the only real world. And so if you really honestly believe that Amber is the only real world, then all that other stuff, as amazing as it seems to you and me, is never going to satisfy a real Amberite, because they're going to know that that to them is like if you and I had a dollhouse we were playing with.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, the ones that do, how can I put this? In the end, are more inherently noble.
Yeah.
Are the ones that don't have that idea, because Benedict has lived in shadow all these years, and he doesn't look at his people as, you know, playthings or not real.
Mm-hmm.
And Random loses himself, and he enjoys doing his thing off in shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And then Corwin living all those centuries upon centuries on Earth. Mm-hmm. They've all been changed, you know, from to one degree or another.
Yeah. And one of the neat things about these books is that Corwin and, you know, Zelazny and by extension Corwin constantly speculates on that. I mean, over and over and over, Corwin will say to us that he's trying to wrestle with those very ideas you're talking about there. I mean, he's aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he realizes that he's being changed by all of this. And that's one of my favorite things about the books, the series too, is that Corwin really does become a different person by the end. I mean, it's obvious in retrospect that he has become a different person even before the story starts. But when it starts up with him having amnesia, he basically has to rebuild his personality from square one, and he becomes a better person for it. Let's get into two more things, because we've got to wrap up. One is I want to talk about the very end and what you thought about how it ended. And then I just want to get your overall impressions of this series, kind of to put a period on the end of it. So the ending, just to kind of move to the very ending, because again, if you folks out there, you want to know the whole story in detail, read the books. They're not that long. They're five short books. But at the end, you get the big showdown between basically Brand and everybody at the Courts of Chaos next to the Abyss, whatever it is. And we get the fate of Deirdre. We get the return of Cain, who was the dead body at the very beginning of what we were talking about tonight. and you get the fate of those characters. So what ends up happening in brief is that Bran gets shot with silver arrows by Cain, but he drags Deirdre with him down into the pit, which I assume means they're gone forever dead. That's certainly the way Corwin thinks it. And then, so first tell me what you thought about that, and then what you think about who ends up being the chosen one to be the new ruler.
Okay. Initially, when I read that, you know, when I very first read it, I was really annoyed by it because Corwin does not get his just desserts basically by getting to face, Bran. He doesn't get to do what it's kind of been building up to, where it's
right.
Like this guy's been behind everything and our hero's going to get to, you know, kick his butt a little. No, instead we get this guy that's pretty much a jerk.
Yeah.
Kane, that's pulled one over on everyone and isn't very apologetic about it at all. He pops up, kills Bran, but in doing so, Bran drags, it's alluded to throughout the books. I don't think we mentioned it, that Deirdre is pretty much Corwin's favorite of all his siblings.
Yeah, I think we talked about that list.
Little bit between them, more between them. And so he drags off kills the one person that Corwin's closest to. So that annoyed me at the beginning, but you know, the very first time I read it, and this was long, long time ago, but you know, reading it since then, I understand that ending. It kind of reminds me like in the first podcast, I was saying how that Corwin's kind of like a hard-boiled PI mm-hmm. type character.
Absolutely.
But set in a fantasy sci-fi world.
Mm-hmm.
And the PI characters never get the girl. And they never really get that really nice, you know, happy ending. It's just one more thing upon them.
That's true.
And you know, added to that, you know, he has that taken away from him, but now he has his son. You know, and here's his son that he can now, you know, interact with. And that's basically what he's doing at the end. This entire book has been him, mm-hmm. or entire series has been him telling the story to Merlin on that hill side of the hill there after the battle.
Yeah, and he's decided he didn't really want the crown anyway, which ticked off his dad after all this. He's like, dude, all this, you don't want it? Ah.
Yeah, he decided that, you know, that he loved Amber and he would do his duty, but the actual ruling of it wasn't for him.
Mm-hmm.
That basically the only reason he wanted it at the beginning was because Eric wanted it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and he exactly. didn't want Eric to have it.
Right.
And I mean, the choice, I mean, what choices are there of who they chose? I mean, I'm Julian Kane. No, Benedict, he's more than capable. But he could have had it a long time ago.
Yeah.
So he definitely doesn't want it.
Gerard's
smart enough.
Right. I was like, he's the one that's trustworthy enough, but not really sharp enough.
Yeah. So who do you get? You get the guy, you get the only other guy that's significantly changed throughout the book to be the king.
Plus nobody has that much of a beef against him. Like they would if it was Julian or somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody really is out to get him. You know, he's not really on bad terms with anybody.
Because he's the youngest.
Yeah. And
in part.
And the thing is, like I said, he's gone from being kind of this little weaselly, little thug type guy, you know, towards mm-hmm. the beginning. He's changed a lot throughout the story.
Mm-hmm.
So he's basically the most qualified when you pick random.
I think that just like Zelazny decided halfway through that Ganelon would be Oberon, I think similarly he decided somewhere along in there that Random was going to be the king, and so he started making that overt change because he had no other reason to do it for the story. And I think that's a big part of what, like you said, you mentioned earlier that Vial ends up serving a bigger role than you ever would have thought because she does two things. One, she kind of gets us ready to accept the idea that Random has changed. She's kind of the person that's there as the example that he's changed. But also, and I don't remember if I touched on this a while ago or not, but also she's the one that helps Corin realize the reason he's been doing all this is not out of ambition to be king, but out of duty, that he's become more noble than he even realizes, and he's just being the good soldier and the good son of his father and doing all this just to help because he feels like it's his duty. That was kind of the major revelation to me about Corwin in the later books, is that he's not just a better you know, because it's funny, in the first two books, you get the idea that he's not as good of a person as he's acting like he is. Mm-hmm. And in the later books, you get the impression that he's actually a better person than he really thinks he is.
Yeah.
That's kind of neat.
No, I totally agree with you.
Yeah. All right. So let's look back real quick. The whole five books all together, final thoughts just in general about those. Where does it rate in terms of the things you like and in science fiction and fantasy history? Kind of put this series in perspective for us.
I don't know. You and me have talked about it a little bit, but as you had said earlier, you know, nobody is Rogers. This guy, he, when I came across him, I was reading like Piers Anthony, mm-hmm. Older stuff like Robert A. Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, you know, more hardcore like sci-fi.
Yeah.
And this guy was just a revelation. I mean, Roger was a pure revelation for me. And I still don't ever come across anything that strikes me as, hey, that's even by people like yourself that are influenced by him. I mean, I don't come across something and say, hey, that could have been, you know, easily written by this guy. I can see the influences and I enjoy them, but I don't think there ever will be another Rogers and Lansdyne. And this is like one of my favorite works by him. This series and then the standalone Lord of Light, those are up there. My favorite, tip top, you know, favorite on a list.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I discovered Zelazny and Larry Niven about the same time back in middle school, high school, and I was just frantically reading both. And I remember there came a day like in 11th grade or 12th grade where I said, well, who's my favorite writer? And I said, well, it's got to be Larry Niven or Roger Zelazny, but they're so different. They're so completely different, you know. And because Larry Niven writes stuff that is – it's kind of Clark you know, it's more hard sci-fi.
Sci-fi, exactly.
But he has colorful characters in a way almost like Zelazny almost. But Zelazny stuff is such poetry. It's just it's so lyrical. And I finally decided that even though I had at the time thought of myself as purely a sci-fi guy, that even though Zelazny stuff is a little more fantasy than sci-fi, though he does both, he is by far my favorite. And he's who I have emulated throughout most of my career. I mean, you know, the Sentinels books don't really draw much from him, but man, all my sci-fi stuff, certainly Lucian, Baranek, and all this stuff, those wouldn't exist if I hadn't discovered Roger Zelazny. He really is he's in my writing DNA more than anything else. And I think that these are classics. I just worry that, that they're not getting, discovered by the next couple of generations, you know? I mean, they only recently did Nine Princes come out on Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the audiobooks of them. The audiobooks are great on Audible. But you can't get the, in fact, I want to say that maybe, what's his name? Wesley Crusher.
Mm-hmm.
I think,
I can't think of his.
I think he reads the second five, the Merlin books.
Will Wheaton.
And he did such a great job on Ready Player One, reading Ready Player One, that I'm seriously thinking about, you know, even though they're short books, I'm seriously thinking about getting them just because that I want to hear his take on, you know, his rendition, his performance of them. So, but I just worry that they're not being discovered by, you know, the next, it's kind of like with Babylon 5, that was so huge in the 90s, but the next couple of generations now, they have no clue what Babylon 5 was because it's not on TV anymore. It's not on Netflix. It's just not anywhere.
Well, it's even more so like another example was like when I was a kid, they would show Doctor Who on PBS.
Yeah.
Down here where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have the what do you call it, the little marathons where they were trying to make money, you know, donations.
Oh, right, on PBS, yeah, the television.
And they would show all the old stuff. And me and my mom and my dad would sit down and watch that. Well, once that went away, there's that enormous gap in between the older Doctor Who and then the new stuff that premiered. And there's a lot of people that they know Doctor Who, but they're only aware of the recent stuff. They've never looked at the older stuff. And it's the same way with Babylon 5. They may be aware of it, but they've never sat down and watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't playing when they were, you know, watching into sci-fi or whatever, since they're younger.
Yeah.
And, that's the big thing about, Zelazny's books, is that pretty much everything I have now, I've gotten used, because that's the only place I can find it at a used bookstore or Half Price Books, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in print.
Yeah, you might can still get the Great Book of Amber a little more easily than some things. But yeah, I've been going out and buying the used copies from the 70s and 80s just because I love them so much and because the covers are so cool, so many of them.
Yeah. No, I agree, because the first, I think I don't know if you remember from the first podcast, I mentioned that I started this out of order. Actually started with the Hand of Oberon.
Right.
Well, that was the old Avon paperback with the red. Edges of the pages and the black, just like you were describing earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my favorite versions. If I could find, I don't have all of those. I have, I think, three of the books still of the Avon versions. And then the other two, cause I buy multiple copies. If I see one
right, in
the used bookstores, I just pick it up if I don't have it. So
I forgot where it was. I think it was when we were in Birmingham for the, that literary thing at the library that I was at a month or so ago. I think I got the last ones. And so I've got all five. I think I've got all five of the black Avon covers, but it took me until now this month to get them. They're not easy to find. People get them and they don't want to let them go. And in fact, when I checked out at the register, the register said, "Oh, if I'd known we had these, I'd already gotten them and you wouldn't have got them."
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Well, we're out of time. We got to wrap up, but I thought this was awesome. We had a nice journey through Amber and Shadow to Chaos. Sean, I want to thank you for coming on doing these two. It's probably going to end up, I'm going to break this one in half, actually, because this was a longer one. We had so much to cover. So these two episodes, that was awesome. And I appreciate you coming on. I hope that you enjoyed it. And maybe we both learned some things we hadn't thought about as much before. So, any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Nope. I had a great time, Van. It was great to be back. Great talking to you and about, you know, pretty much one of our favorite authors.
That's right.
Lensley, you know, go out and read some of his stuff.
That's right.
It's great.
I'll see you guys in Dragon Con in a few days. I'll see you guys in Huntsville at the Rocket City Lit Fest coming up in October and at Archon in October. So come out and see me. I'll have a table or an actual full booth at both of those conventions. So that should be a lot of fun. And make sure you check out Baranak. If you like Roger Zelazny, if you like Amber, please pick up Lucian. And if you read Lucian, you're going to want to get Baranak, the prequel. I think you'll enjoy him. The Rocket's going to get out of here for another episode. Thanks again to Sean, and we will see you guys down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.